It's Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
Robinson hit that ball. It went zooming past the left field wall. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball.
And when he swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball a solid mile. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball.
We just found that one. I say to Paul Dixon, who is my guest tonight and is the author of the new biography of Bill Veeck. Bill Veeck, baseball's greatest maverick. But it came to me that, just as I learned from your book, and in fact I knew this even before I read your book, that the getting black guys into baseball, that we know that Jackie Robinson was the first and that Branch Rickey did that with the old Dodgers, but Bill Veeck was the second one to do it.
Right, and he tried earlier. He actually tried in 1942. He had learned, actually, flashback even further, very early in his career, he owned the Milwaukee Brewers, the minor league Milwaukee team. Right. And the winter of 41-42, when he owned the Brewers, had very little money, and he paired up with a guy named Abe Saperstein, who then owned the Harlem Globetrotters, and they were playing basketball in the upper Midwest or in Milwaukee.
They were the Harlem Globetrotters, but they were based in Chicago.
They were based in Chicago, as were the New York Renaissance, which was another. But what happened was, during that winter, there were all of a sudden, at that point, the Harlem Globetrotters were not a stunt team. They were fully legitimate basketball team. And all of a sudden during that winter, there was some trading back and forth. Some of the black players started playing for the white team. Some of the white players were taking the black teams, et cetera. And all of a sudden, Veeck and Saperstein saw the value in interracial or putting people of both races on the court at the same time actually boosted attendance. So 1942, Veeck hears that the Philadelphia Phillies are for sale. Veeck has this wonderful idea. He realizes that all the old established black players, the Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige, are too old for the draft. They're older men, but they can still play baseball.
Wouldn't they make a great team?
Right, and he's going to buy
the majors.
He's going to buy the Phillies and make it an all-black team. He's thwarted. They don't let him get away with it. They're, it's just too progressive, too fast in terms of race. But
as I remember the story, he confides this to Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who's then the baseball commissioner.
Right, exactly.
And thinking Landis might be enthusiastic for it.
He did, but the carpet gets pulled out from under it.
Sure.
And he knew Landis. I mean, he knew Landis because his father had been president of the Chicago Cubs, Bill Veeck's father. We can talk about that later. But what happened to Veeck is then in the winter of 46-47, Veeck knows there's going to be integration. He knows, and he owns the Cleveland Indians, and he tries to get Ray Dandridge to come up from the Mexico leagues and play for him. Dandridge is making too much money in Mexico. He doesn't want to leave Mexico. But that spring, before Robinson is signed, Veeck actually goes out and hires a front office PR guy who's African-American, black guy, who is also Lena Horne's husband, to prepare for the...
At this time, he owns the Cleveland Indians.
Right, Cleveland Indians. And he's got a lot of backers. He's got not that much money in it. He's got, but he's got, you know, he's got some big-time Chicago bankers, he's got Bob Hope. Bob Hope's a major investor in that club. And he brings up, in 11 weeks after Jackie Robinson, he brings up a wonderful man named Larry Doby. Yeah. And Larry Doby has a lot of problems that Robinson does. And one of the ironies of Doby was grew up in an affluent suburb in New Jersey, and he was treated with great equality growing up. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the great ironies of Doby's life is he plays football for this team in New Jersey. He's on the same team as Frank Lauterbach, you know, the senator from New Jersey. He's actually in the same school, but he plays football against Buzz Aldrin, which, of course, the irony is Aldrin's the second guy on the moon, and here's Doby, the second black man in baseball. But Doby then goes to Long Island University, goes in the military. But when he comes up with the Indians, when Veeck brings him up, there's a lot of race hatred. He expresses the first time. He's never experienced.
I heard about all of this from the manager of the Cleveland Indians, who later on, of course, Lou Boudreaux, later on was a baseball color guy for the Cubs here at WGN. And Lou was a frequent guest on this program a long time ago when I was just beginning to do it. And he had wonderful memories, a wonderful detail. He talked about how antagonistic the crowd was in the stadium.
Yeah. Well, Vex said he gets 20,000 angry letters about racially integrating the team. The team, he actually brings Doby in Chicago. Actually, his first game in the Indians uniform is in Chicago. But it sounds like maybe he's exact 20,000 letters. But I actually found a reporter from back then from the Cleveland Press who was a Cub reporter and was on the sports desk. He said calls would come in all night. These really vile anti-black calls. And so and Vec did a good job. I think Doby's toughest time came. He was on the road with the Indians, and he plays a game in Houston, and they throw rocks at him. He's in a uniform. He has to leave the field.
He's a very colorful guy. I knew him just a little, and I want to talk with you about that later. But let's listen to him now and again through the program. He was interviewed all over the place. Yeah. He had some of his own gigs on radio.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, a talk show on television here in town, on one of the ultra-frequency channels, as they used to call them in those days. Here is Bill Beck. I'm not quite sure who he's talking to, but this is fascinating stuff.
We've lived nicely, Mayor Francis and I. We don't live expensively. We live nicely. We do what we want to do. We aren't deprived of things. But on the other hand, we don't have free cars. The cars we got are old. We don't have several houses. The one we live is very modest. Our wants are very modest. Maybe because nothing is any better just because it costs more. And I think that's a mistake that we've made in our society is correlating cost with value and cost with return. And they have no correlation. And I guess you learn that because you see a ball player who gets $1 million who can't play, you know? At $100,000, he would be stealing. And the fact is, you pay him $1 million doesn't make him that much better, and it doesn't mean that you've gotten that much greater return. And that's true of, well, how much money can you pay a tulip to bloom, you know? And how much more can you pay a song to hum? So I wonder what relationship money has to being happy, to enjoying your world and your life. I think very little.
Isn't that great stuff?
It is great stuff. You know, at one point...
He's a great talker. And he's really got attitudes that are sincere and honest, and he's not faking.
But at one point I found in the Library of Congress, I had over 300 five-minute broadcasts he'd done for Armed Forces Radio, and it was just extemporaneous. I sat in a booth with earphones and listened for a day and a half, listened to him. Some of the broadcasts I listened to twice. He was the most eloquent speaker. Mm-hmm. He had a certain rhythm and a pace, but he had ways of speaking. He could never say... he would never say woman. He would say the female of the species.
Uh-huh.
And he had a slightly Victorian construct. He would say if he had an inept... outfielder. He would not say the guy was inept. He would say he was no gazelle of the greensward. You know, he would.
Wonderful.
But again, he was a very, very. He was a man in unbelievable pain all of his life. He wore a wound that led to over 16 amputations. Yet he was always calm and funny and whimsical and observant. He always had these fascinating hobbies. He was we talk about the baseball, but he later in life he became fascinated with mobiles, the moving sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
And he produced many of them. They were shown in galleries here in Chicago. And he was, he got very interested when he was in the Southwest in American Indian art, and he got deeply involved in that. And because of the amputations, he would have to soak the stump of his leg every morning for 3 or 4 hours. He'd get up early and soak it in the hot water because of the chafing from the prosthesis. And he would read everything. He'd go from Shakespeare to some potboiler novel. He would read everything. And there were times he would go to the American Booksellers Association conventions and get up there and start quoting Keats and quoting Shakespeare and quoting Hemingway. And he just had this wonderful sort of ability to read.
He did two memoirs, or was it three?
Three, yeah.
And the first one was titled, the great title.
Vec as in Wreck.
Vec as in Wreck.
Yes.
Yes. So, and he joked constantly about his own disability.
Yeah. Now, that one of the things that was interesting about doing his biography is because you had the Beck Is in Rec, which is an autobiography, yeah. And I was looking at a lot of different things, things that, you know, he discharged his whole military service in the Beck Is in Rec in a couple of sentences, I think three sentences, whereas I, you know, brought it out as a huge, a full chapter, and it was
He was a fighting Marine during the war, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was interesting. The Marines wanted, he all of a sudden out of the blue, he owns the Milwaukee Brewers minor league team. Out of the blue, in 1943, he decides he's going to sign up for the Marines. The Marines, at this point, he's very famous. He's a big promoter. He's had a lot of wild promotions up there in Milwaukee. The Marines, oh, my gosh, we got a great recruiter. He'll go out there. He'll be like a big-time recruiter. And Beck said, no, I'm not going to recruit anyone else. It's my decision to go into the war. I feel I should be here. He could have been deferred. He had children at that point. But he wanted to replace a younger man who didn't have the resources he did. And he demanded to go into combat. And I actually found the sergeant who had been his boss in the South Pacific. He was in Bougainville in the South Pacific.
He would have been about 30 at the time, I was guessing.
Yeah, yeah. And he was, I think he was just over 30. Yeah. And he gets down there, and he's a character down there. I mean, he's demanding, he'll go, the Japanese lines were only hundreds of yards away. There were Japanese firing, and he would get out there, never swore, but he'd get out there and provoke hurl insults at the Japanese. And while he was there, apparently this sergeant who I found, who was his boss down there in the island, now in a nursing home, things would happen with Vec. He said, you couldn't believe. He said, all of a sudden one day in a combat zone, we're fighting there. This plane arrives. It's loaded with bats and balls and gloves. He said, Vec somehow got all this baseball equipment sent in. Then he's still in the combat zone. He's trading players with other minor league teams. And people say, no, you can't do this. But he gets, ultimately what happens to him, he's an artillery guy, anti-aircraft gun, recoils. Doesn't get out of the way quickly enough. It severely rips his foot, cuts his foot. Yeah. And he's in a tropical environment. An infection ensues, and he's sick. You know,
fabulous character. But we've jumped right into the middle, so to speak. We haven't really grown him up and looked at his forebears and looked at his formative years and looked at his very interesting father, who sets a model for Bill to follow. We'll deal with all of that with Paul Dixon, who's done a wonderful biography of Bill Vec, subtitled Baseball's Greatest Maverick. And indeed, that's a good, important part of the career as well. Maverick in the sense that he offended almost all of the other major baseball owners.
Yes.
He made life hot for them and difficult for them, all the while pleasing the crowds tremendously.
Yes.
We'll deal with all of that as we return. Hear more Bill Vec as well after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Go get it,
Say hey, Willie, go get it.
What do you mean, go get it? Man, that ball's way in left field.
I don't care what field it's in. Willie plays all field.
Every time we come to the game, you're talking about Willie plays all the field.
That's right.
Let's call Willie and ask him. Call him.
Okay. Hey, Willie.
Yes.
Are you Willie Mays?
Yes.
Whose ball was that?
Why was it?
In left field.
Well, that's Urban's ball.
I told you that. Every time we come to the game, we got to talk about it. The next time, I'm going to sit in the grandstand.
Say, hey, fellas, what's your name?
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey,
say who?
Swinging at the plate, say hey,
say who?
Say Willie, that giant kid is great. When he hits the ball, it's long gone, man. Hits it farther than camp begins. Swings the bats like a little lead pipe. When they reach the ball, it's overripe. Say hey,
say who?
So there's another baseball song, this one about Willie Mays. When those black guys came along, they may have annoyed some people for a while, as we heard with regard to Adobe premiering here in Chicago with the Indians. But basically, they were very exciting baseball players.
Yeah. I mean, what
they inspired Tin Pan Alley to write songs about?
Oh well, no, it had to happen eventually, and I think Vec and Branch Rickey made it happen. I think when they really get mad at Vec. Is in 1948, he's trying to win, and he ultimately wins the American League Championship and then wins the World Series. He basically gets them really angry because he brings up Satchel Paige, who at this time is a man in his late 40s, an old man. And the powers that be in baseball, they were fine with Jackie Robinson and they were fine with Dobie because they were young guys. And they'd both been in the service and the whole business. But for years they've been saying these Negro League guys, like Satchel Paige and like Josh Gibson, could never compete with the white guys. They were different. They were much lower caliber. They were really clowns. They couldn't really play. So when Paige comes up, they know that they're going to be, it's all going to be proven to be a lie. They bring it to this old man, and he helps them win the pennant in the World Series.
He has great stuff. He doesn't have a fastball anymore, but he has every trick in the game.
Right, and precision. Yeah. And he partially, it's just the whole demeanor out there, the way he drops his shoulder, yeah, the way he goes. And, of course, at that point, Vec is now realizing that the great salvation for baseball is integration. And in 49, so when you go, 47 is Dobie, 48 is Satchel Paige. 49, he brings 14 African-Americans to spring training. And that includes Luke Easter, and it includes Minnie Minosa, and it includes Paige, and it includes Dobie, and guys you've never heard of. But that's more than everybody else had together. And, of course, at this point, he starts really razzing the American League, the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Detroit Tigers, who don't want to integrate. Of course, Vec's great moment comes when Satchel Paige pitches in Yankee Stadium and he fills every seat in the house. And Vec thinks this is hysterical because the Yankees are saying the New York fans aren't ready for a black player. Yeah.
And Vec always had it in for the Yankees anyway.
Oh, he loved it. It was like he was born to be a Yankee hater. Why was that? He thought they were stuffed shirts. He thought they would never, early on, he got in a big battle with them over television revenue sharing in 47, he gets in a big battle with the Yankees. And of course, they still haven't resolved the issue of revenue sharing and television sharing in baseball. And I think he picks on them for that. And I think the other thing was, there is just this cultural difference between him and them. I asked Andy McPhail, whose father and grandfather had been great names in baseball. And I said to Andy, who was then general manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and I said to Andy, I said, why? Because he knew Vec growing up. I said, why did they hate him so much? Why did the Yankees, why did those guys, the stuffed shirts, the old, the established guys hate him so much? He said they hated him because he was against the reserve clause. They hated him for the fact that he testified in favor of the Curt Flood trial. But he said the real reason they hated him was he sat in the bleachers with the fans. Mm-hmm. And he said, for these guys who were imperial and aloof and corporate, to having a guy sit out there in the bleachers and a kid come up to Vec and say, hey, Mr. Vec, these hot dogs are lousy. And Vec would give him $2 and say, go buy another one. It was just the fact that he was so fan-friendly that irked them.
Let's go back to his origins.
Sure.
And back to his father.
Yes. Bill Vec, Bill Vec's father was a great newspaper man here in Chicago, right under the name of Bill Bailey. And was in 1920, and surprising everybody, was appointed president of the Chicago Cubs. One of the things I discuss in my book at great length is I suggest that one of the reasons that Vec Sr. was a newspaper man, was converted into the president of the Cubs, was in fact that he had understood that the 1918 World Series, the Cubs versus the Red Sox, had been fixed. Everybody knows the 1919 Red Sox World Series had been fixed with the Blacks, so-called Black Sox. And Vec was on to something. He had actually, when he gets to be president of the Cubs in 1920, he actually finds gamblers trying to influence Cubs games and calls in the Pinkertons to investigate, and then calls on a grand jury or sets off a grand jury, which then investigates all of the corruption in baseball at the time, which was quite significant. And so his father comes into baseball as a reformer, anti-gambling, strictly anti-gambling, trying to clean up baseball. His father also has a tremendous effect on the Cubs. He starts Ladies Day. He's the first one. He realized this, that in order to really make money in baseball, you can't just rely on the guys with straw hats and the ties. You got to start bringing women and children, families in. So he has these tremendous Ladies Day. Women come free and they come later and they can buy a better seat. And then he does all these other things to appeal to a larger audience. He's the first guy to actually put a woman in the front office. There's a woman named Carlson that he promotes to in the front office. And he's really a trying to change baseball, trying to make it better, and he's looking at new ways. He's advocating interleague play. He said there's no reason why the Cubs and the White Sox shouldn't play during the regular season.
This is the father.
This is the father.
And,
yeah.
And Bill Beck did all of that later on.
Yeah.
Interleague and play and...
Everything, yeah.
And, all of those innovations,
right.
Including some uniquely his own,
right.
including the little guy.
Oh, well.
In the one game. One dreadful thing where he misfired, apparently, yeah. was an event at Wrigley Field called Demolition Derby.
Oh, that was at Comiskey Park.
Rather at Comiskey Park.
Yeah, and that was later towards the end of his fourth
when he was managing owning and running.
And it was
the
a
White
bad,
Sox.
Yeah, that was crime. A lot of people think of the bookends of Beck's life, and that's the sad piece at the end of the story. But I think there was, you know, just to, you know, fish back for just 1 second to the mm-hmm. Cubs thing, because when his father dies in 1933, because a lot of people don't know this, when Beck's father dies in 1933, he dies of leukemia. And one of the stories is his father is very ill, and his father had a great interest in, loved to sip on champagne.
Uh-huh.
So he put out the word that in his final days of life, he liked to have some French champagne. And at one of his final days, a big crate of champagne is on their porch, and it says, "Compliments of Al Capone." So that's... but Beck takes over goes to the work for the Cubs in 1933. The Wrigleys give him the job. Wrigley gives him the job of going through the stadiums, finding what the people really want, and asking them what they want, how they want to improve the game. During this course, he meets all these interesting characters. Like there's a program hustler named Jack Ruby. He gets to be friendly with it. And there's another guy who's a paper salesman, comes in and sells paper cups, whose name is Ray Kroc, who's going to become the head of McDonald's. But in 1937, Wrigley, he's worked his way up to the point where Wrigley says, gives Bill Beck the job of redoing the stadium, of Wrigley Field. He said, all right, go, you know, do it. And part of what he does, he reshapes the bleachers, the sight lines you see there mm-hmm. today.
And he puts in the ivy.
He puts in the ivy, yeah. So that's he's off to a great start with the Cubs.
And we're off to a fine start in this conversation, which will continue right after an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Let me hear you, good and loud. A one, a two, a three. Take me out to the ball.
There, Harry is singing Roots for the Cubbies, but when he did it the first time, he would have necessarily have sung Roots for the White Sox.
Yes, right. Yes.
Because what does all this have to do with Bill Beck? You will now explain.
Beck, when he came back the second time, just to give the listeners just a quick, he owned five teams. He owned the minor league Milwaukee Brewers, and then he owned the Cleveland Indians 46-50, then the St. Louis Browns 51-53, and then the White Sox for the first time 59-61, the last time 1975 to 1980.
By the way, a side note, when we say he owned them, he didn't own them solely. He fronted for them. He had money in the corporation, but he had lots of other backers.
Right. People like Bob Hope and a lot of...
As you mentioned earlier,
many, many people. But in 1976, he's got the White Sox for the second time. He really wants to get things going with the White Sox. And the first year is a wonderful year of just experimentation. Mm-hmm. He puts them in shorts. There's the famous pictures of the White Sox.
Just for one game, is that?
Just for one game, but it was trying. And he also does things at Bicentennial, July 4th. He marches on the field with his peg leg. By this time, he's wearing a full wooden leg. And they do reenact the spirit of 76 with a fife and the drum guy and the bandage on their head. But it's during this period that he brings in Harry Carey as an announcer. He knows he needs a voice.
He brings him from St. Louis, as I remember.
Right, yes. He brings him in, and then one time, dawns on him at one time, he hears Carey singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, But he's not mic'd. He's just singing it to himself. He's out there sort of singing it, and the other things are going on, ads are going. And he's singing it, and Vex gets this great idea. He said he's got to mic him and have him project out over the ballpark because, he said, Carey's voice was so bad that he knew that everybody in the ballpark knew they could sing it better than Harry Carey could. Yeah. So that's the beginning of that. And during that same period, Nancy Faust, the organist, starts playing with this na-na-na-na, hey-hey-hey, goodbye thing. And all these things sort of happen in that second incarnation with the White Sox, which, like it or not, are still part of our what he added to baseball.
I want to play another clip of Harry. And you mentioned Bob Hope a few times. Here he is. Hope was a partner.
Yeah.
With the White Sox?
No, with the Indians.
With the Indians way back then. And here he is on Bob Hope's radio program. That is number five on our list.
Yes, sir. Right now, folks, it's a pleasure to introduce a man who brought showmanship to big-time baseball. A guy who, in a great measure, was responsible for bringing the world's baseball crown to Cleveland, the former Fighting Marine and now president of the Cleveland Indians Baseball Club, Mr. Bill Veeck, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Certainly a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's good to have you, Bill.
You know, I've been sitting over here watching the show. You've got a lot of rackets, haven't you?
Well, don't look at it that way. Let's get down to business. Did you bring my share with you?
Huh? Bob, take it a little easy. You know, we haven't counted all that dough yet.
There's a lot there to count to. I wish I could help you. But look, Bill, seriously, with me, money is secondary. The thing that matters with me is sentiment. You see, I have a great fondness for the city of Cleveland. After all, I grew up there, and I love that town.
That's a wonderful attitude, Bob. Of course, I had a check here for several thousand dollars, but because of your attachment to Cleveland, you won't want it.
Shake hands with a tourist. But seriously, Bill, it's swell having you here. We both have so much in common. For instance, we're both big men in the sports world, aren't we? Well, we're both big men. Well, we're both men. Call for Philip Morris. But I hope you appreciate the great moral support I gave the Indians when I was back there for the series.
Moral support? Bob, you really embarrassed us back there.
How?
Well, whenever Lou Boudreau sent a player to the showers, he looked so silly, run along behind him, yelling, "You swan, you get more bubbles."
Yeah, and I had to run in for my free seat in the bleacher. I mean, my seat in the bleacher. What the? I had to run in for my seat in the bleachers to do it.
Bob, you had a real good seat. Right at the north end of the stadium.
Yeah, it was north, all right. It was so far north, there were two people next to me wearing fur coats and rubbing noses. And a guy kept coming around selling hot blubber on a roll.
Gotta keep your family working some way.
What do you do, write stuff on the plane? What are you doing? Well, I want you to know that I was ready to get in the game anytime you wanted me, Bill. Of course, you know I'm an all-around athlete.
Bob, I could tell you were an athlete the first time I laid eyes on you. Just take a look at those big, broad shoulders. The tremendous chest and lean, hard stomach and the bulging biceps.
Honest, Bill?
Truly.
I have so much more than gorgeous George. Why should I fight him? But you know, Bill, around Cleveland, they tell me that you seldom wear a tie. Is that right?
That's right, Bob. And after that tie of the Red Sox, I'll guarantee I'll never wear one.
That was rough. I don't blame you. That American League playoff left me a nervous wreck, too. I chewed my fingernails all the way down to my wristwatch.
Among other things that occurs to me, comedy has surely changed since then.
That sure has. But
that's real old-time radio.
But and of course, Veeck had this relationship with Hope that was rather extraordinary. Hope had been a boxer in Cleveland, loved Cleveland. He fought under the name of Packy West.
Yeah.
That was his name. And then when they got to be very close, and there's actually a picture in the book when Veeck has his first amputation, this leg which has been damaged in this combat zone, he has the first amputation. And a couple days later, he just had his major part of his leg taken off. You know, Bob Hope's there, and they're mugging for the camera. And that goes through his whole life with his leg as almost a prop. You know, he builds, at one point, he builds an ashtray into the the wooden leg, and he would be in the middle of some negotiation. He'd roll up his pants leg and pull out the ashtray and snuff out.
That's his running gag.
Yeah, and he had one of the kids told me that he had one time when they were in the Eastern Shore, one of his children told me that he had a deck paint, and he had this wooden leg. He'd given up the stainless steel prosthesis for the wooden leg, and he would actually paint it during the course of the summer to make it look like he was getting a deeper and deeper suntan. So
he had a tremendous openness towards, or maybe a great interest in, other people. He was indeed one of the friendliest people one can possibly imagine. And I've got a story about that. I met him shortly after I got to Chicago. And I got to Chicago in 1965. And it must have been in the late 60s, 67 or 68, that I was invited to come on a television program that he hosted. It was just a talk show. And I came and had a good time with it. That was before I started doing this radio gig, completely before. I didn't know anything about talk shows, but as a professor of whatever I was at the University of Chicago, he wanted me on the program. And about 3 or 4 years later, I'm on an airplane coming back from London, or from Paris, I guess, from Paris. I'd been to an international psychology meeting in London, then I went on to Paris, and then I'm flying back, and we're supposed to go to Washington, where I've got some other things to do. But the weather is bad, and we're diverted. The plane is diverted to Logan Airport in Boston. And it's about 2 in the morning or something of the sort. And I'm with a few other people that I got to talk with on the plane. We decide we'll go get a drink at the bar in the airport. We walk into this low-lit bar. There's some music playing softly in the background. And off to my left, somebody says, "Professor Rosenberg." And I looked around. I didn't see anything. And he calls me again, and I walk over, and it's Bill Beck. This was when he was out of Chicago and managing the racetrack
in Boston.
Suffolk Downs, wasn't it?
Yeah,
in Suffolk Boston.
Downs, yeah.
What years did he
do that? Was Suffolk Downs would be 69 to 72.
And this would have been 71 or 72, yeah. I guess. And he invited me and the two people I was with as well to sit down. He was there with some other people in a big booth, yeah. And we crowded into that booth, and we sat there for the next 2 or 3 hours, yeah. Through the whole night, just chatting. And it wasn't about baseball particularly. One of the guys was a lawyer, maybe his lawyer, I don't know. But it was just a very interesting evening. A wonderful way to spend the time till we could get on another plane to go to Washington.
And you know, the period when he handled the racetrack was fascinating, because he took all these wacky promotional ideas that he was doing in baseball, and like one of the things for the racetrack, he did things like bought up all the chariots that they'd use in the movie Ben-Hur.
Oh, really?
And he had a chariot race at Suffolk Downs. Then he had these other crazy, he had a Lady Godiva, only women jockeys could ride.
Uh-huh.
And he did all this stuff. But in the meantime, he gets involved in Boston in all these other things. Like, there's a plan, right when he gets there, to rip down Fenway Park and replace it with a sort of a cookie-cutter stadium for football and baseball. And he becomes a real defender of Fenway.
The Great Green Wall. You can't take that down.
He said, "You people are you're going to allow them to take down the other great stadium in baseball, which are the other than being Wrigley."
Yeah.
And then he gets involved in things like, the Boston Patriots, the football team, is going to be evicted from Boston because they don't have a big enough stadium. And Vec gets involved in this very complicated plan to run some extra paramutual days at the racetrack to raise money for a new stadium. Mm-hmm. It's not the solution, but it's the kind of thing that allows them to stay, because they're playing with his ideas. So he gets involved in basically keeping the Patriots in Boston, and he gets involved in other things like this, where he comes out of the blue. There's a moment in which the Secretary of the Interior, Udall, is concerned because George Preston Marshall will not racially integrate the Washington Redskins, and he's stuck because it's a federally owned facility, but here's the guy running basically a Jim Crow operation. And Vec comes in, he says, well, he goes to Udall, he says, "Well, you know what we should do is," he said, "throw him out, throw out the Redskins, and I'll bring an AFL team into Washington." And of course, it never happened, but he was always throwing his sort of his hat in the ring. Mm-hmm. I got a great idea, which Udall then could use.
He didn't make a lot of money, though, did he?
He made enough. And he made a lot of money for his investors. Cleveland,
yeah.
For every dollar person put in, 4 years later, he gave him 20. And he had to sell a couple times. He was at one time when in Cleveland, he had a divorce that he had to pay for. He had children's education he was going to pay for. But he couldn't keep the team because his taxable rate was confiscatory. It was over 90%. During those days, just from general income, he could make money from selling the team and the capital gains. But he was at a high enough salary or high enough earned income that it was over 90%. He just couldn't afford to live anymore, and so he gets involved in a lot of things like this where he has to sell the team for some other reason.
Speaking of money, we're late for some commercials.
Oh, there you go.
Directly back to Paul Dixon. We're drawing from his wonderful biography of Bill Beck, titled quite directly Bill Beck. Subtitled Baseball's Greatest Maverick. That's just published by Walker. It's a superb read, and everybody will want to get their hands on it. By the way, before we go to our commercials, let's do a commercial for you. You're doing an appearance at a local bookstore.
This Friday at 1 o'clock, 1 p.m. at the Bookseller in Lincoln Square. That's 4736 North Lincoln here in Chicago. Friday at 1 p.m.
Excellent. And we'll be directly back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Here is a blurb, one might properly call it, but from a man who doesn't blurb very frequently, a friend of mine and obviously a friend of yours as well, Jim Lehrer, who says about this book, Bill Beck, in the language of the subject, is a home run, a bases clearer. The story of the remarkable full life of this pioneering baseball character is told with the steadiness, detail, and flair that we've come to expect from Paul Dixon, the premier all-star writer and reporter. The book is great fun, much like being in the bleachers during a day game.
Thank you. Thanks for reading that, yes.
Yeah, well, it's very well phrased, and I'm sure it's sincerely meant and felt. There's also an excellent blurb here by another friend of mine, Clarence Page, who's the columnist for this paper, Washington-based, yes. And I won't read it at the moment, but he's equally enthusiastic. Listen to Bill Beck again on what we've been talking about, making baseball fun for the fans.
What's behind your theory of showmanship in baseball?
Well, I happen to have a very ridiculous theory, according to many ball club operators, that it should be fun. You know, I don't think that baseball is such a grim, serious thing. Sure, I don't want to interfere with the game, but I do want everyone who comes out the ballpark to have fun. And look, let's face it. Often the ball game is not the most exciting thing that ever's happened.
I have always operated on the theory that your fans, who are customers or patrons, but more nearly our friends, should be treated exactly the same way in a ballpark, as far as it's humanly possible, as if they were in your home. Because in reality, they are guests, with one exception. Really, maybe that you're the guest, and the ballpark belongs to them more accurately than it belongs to you. You're merely the custodian of their ballpark. So I've tried to operate it that way.
And we've named some of the fun things he did and introduced into baseball. The single item he's most remembered for is that little episode with the St. Louis Browns and. The man isn't called a midget. He's called a little man.
Yes.
I don't know why. What the distinction is.
No, he wasn't a midget. He was a. In 1951, Bill Beck takes over the St. Louis Browns, which was a team that was in great disrepair. The attendance was down.
They're now the Baltimore Orioles, isn't that right?
They became, yes. They became, yeah. After 3 years. But Bill Beck had read a James Thurber short story in The New Yorker in which a baseball team had. Brought aboard a midget who basically, whenever they needed a base runner, the midget would come to the plate and crouch down so that his strike zone would be about the size of a playing card or something. And of course, he would get walked. And Beck really thought about this, and he found a theatrical midget, a guy who played was a midget, but also played himself in vaudeville and was a real character named Eddie Goodell. He was 3'7" tall. And he basically brought him into the second game of a doubleheader, He came in, he crouched, he had a contract that they showed the umpire to make sure that they knew he was officially on the team, and he crouched, and of course he was walked, went to first base, and once he reached first base, he was removed and a pinch runner ran in. But the photograph of that was in every paper in the English-speaking world and yes. the rest of the world together. And it set off this huge repercussion in baseball. They were angry at Beck. He sort of ruined the purity of the game. And Goodell himself was for a moment a wonderful character. He went on television. He was on the Milton Berle show, and he had this real sort of tough Chicago sound. Goodell, he said I could have been Babe Ruth, you know. But also what Beck had done in that, even though he was very strongly criticized for it, and of course he had great rebuttals. He wanted to have Roald Dropo Major League Baseball declared that no midgets could play baseball, and then he wanted to have Phil Rizzuto checked, and he also wanted to have Walt Dropo. I think was 6'8". He said he was a giant. They should ban, if they're going to ban, you know, small people, they should ban large people too. But what really happened with that incident and the Eddie Goodell thing, that he that famous picture of him crouching at the plate, was Beck had really prepared baseball for the television age. It was, you know, baseball was starting to lose out to television, the Milton Berle shows. People wouldn't come to the games because they wanted to be home and watching these shows. And so that image, all of a sudden people say, wait a second, I'll go to the ball game tonight. Something strange may happen, some strange interlude.
Fun at the old ballpark.
And he did things that were just outrageous.
What were some of the others?
I mean, he favorite one, Milwaukee, he starts it. He gives away farm animals. He gives away, he'll give somebody a brace of pigeons. And one night he said, it was one thing, he said, anybody can give 10,000 fans each a can of beer. But he said, if you give one fan 10,000 cans of beer, it's funny. He did stuff like, he would give away a keg of nails. And there was another one. He would advertise that the lucky fan tonight will get 100 silver dollars. This is 1942, and it's a lot of money, silver dollars. And, of course, somebody would win it, and then he'd bring a huge wheelbarrow, and it would be frozen, a huge block of ice. The guy would have to sit there all night for the ice to melt. But he gets to Cleveland, you know, and when he takes over the Cleveland Indians in 46, there's this huge, huge paucity of nylon stockings. There's a huge rationing, a shortage. The women can't get their nylon stockings. They're immensely popular. Vex somehow gets a hold of a truckload of nylon stockings, and he says, all right, any woman who comes to the ballpark, I think it was Mother's Day, and on ballpark, will get a pair of nylon stockings. And this is immensely popular. And he, but the rest of baseball is appalled. They said, wait a second, you're giving away nylon stockings at a ball game. And then, of course, they're so upset. It seems to be so unbecoming to baseball that they're giving away stockings. Then he gives away orchids on another day. He gives all the women orchids. But he has this, one of his litanies through these teams is, you know, he comes into a new ballpark, he rips out the old ladies from the powder rooms, redoes them. At one point at the White Sox, they have a brand new, beautiful women's room put in. They have a contest as to what to name it. And a woman I actually interviewed for the book won the contest, and she submitted her, and it was called the Hall of Femme.
Uh-huh.
That was
yes.
But he really did bring women and families, just like his father, to the ballpark. And I think, you know, you could say that this $2 billion they just paid for the Dodgers, that Beck really did He really increased the fan base. He really brought many more women to the game and as fans, and many more minorities to the game as fans. And so I think the value of a lot of these teams today, and to some degree, is a result of Vec's real desire to make it a broader audience for baseball.
He also had considerable influence upon how the business is structured.
Yes.
We've talked about some of the rules that he ultimately introduced or changed. But it seems to me the whole business of baseball and the structure of baseball was influenced by him in ways that, for one thing, helped the players to get very, very rich.
He was, and when he was 18 years old, he writes to Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who is the Chicago-based commissioner of baseball, who's been basically brought in to clean up the game. And at 18, he writes Landis a letter. He'd known Landis as a kid mm-hmm. growing up because of his father. And he wrote him, he said he thinks this reserve clause, which is that which bound a player to his team for as long as the team wanted to keep him, He basically attacked it. He said it was immoral and illegal. And Landis wrote back and said, you know, young man, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. But he kept going on this the whole time. He kept saying that we got it. We can't. This is like indentured servitude.
Is he in a way responsible for free agency?
He's partially. He testifies at the famous Kurt Flood trial.
Yeah.
And he makes a passion plea for it. And yes, he is one of the crusaders. He pushes it, pushes and pushes it. And then, of course, when he gets the White Sox for the second time, it comes around to bite him. He now can't afford the players.
Mm-hmm.
But he lives with it. But he's also, the principle was more important to him than the reality, because he comes up, he even turns that into rent a player. We're
about to pause for an update on the news. But you know, one thing we haven't yet talked about, and it's quite fascinating, one learns a great deal about it in the book, is the private man.
Yes.
We've talked about his public life, which was always splendiferously innovative, to say the least.
Yes.
And often ran a gag to its logical or its illogical conclusion, but in the way which commended him to all who were covering baseball, all who were covering American public life, so to speak. He became a great public character,
yes,
by virtue of this stuff. But the private life is of considerable interest as well.
Yes.
And we might turn to that when we return in conversation with Paul Dixon after the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
It's Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
Hello, Joe. What do you know?
We need a hit, so here I go.
Ball one.
Yay!
Ball two.
Yay!
Strike one.
Ooh!
Strike two.
Kill that umpire.
Yay!
A
case of Wheaties.
Not a free Jolton Joe DiMaggio.
Joe, Joe DiMaggio, we want you and I.
He tied the mark at 44, July the 1st, you know. Since then he's hit a good 12 more, Jolton Joe DiMaggio.
Joe, Joe DiMaggio, we want you and I.
From coast to coast, that's all you'll hear of Joe, the one-man show. He's glorified the horse-hide sphere, Jolton Joe DiMaggio.
Joe, Joe DiMaggio.
Couldn't resist that one. We've had a number of songs. They were all sort of Tin Pan Alley tunes that were successful about particular baseball players. I don't think we have those anymore, do we?
Not really. It's all changed. You know, baseball used to be like grand opera where you had Casey Stengel and you had Ruth, mm-hmm, you know, the prodigal son, and you had Dizzy Dean, the sort of the wise bucolic
right,
country boy, and you had, you know, all these different people, Leo DeRocher, the sort of the lippy.
Leo the Lip.
Leo the Lip, yeah. You know, and who was married to Lorraine Day.
That's right.
But there were all these different, you know, it was Lou Gehrig, the sort of the tragic hero, Jackie Robinson, the Black Knight, you know, the prince who comes in and saves baseball from its own prejudices. But and they had nicknames, and they was wonderful. They gave great quotes. I remember the great quote, I once did a book on baseball quotations, and DiMaggio, they ask him when he comes up, they ask him for a quote, and he thinks he doesn't know. He doesn't know what it is. He thinks it's a soft drink. He said, somebody says, can we have a quote? And he's looking around for a bottle of quote, you know. So, but it's the Satchel Pages and the Yogi Berras and these guys who were, you
Satchel
know,
Page, don't look back. Somebody may be gaining on you.
Oh yeah, he had a whole rules for life, you know, don't eat fried foods, they angry up the blood. And
yeah.
Of course, he ate a lot of fried foods.
My favorite Casey Stengel, I've used it often, is don't nobody here know how to play this game.
I know.
It's an all-purpose quotation. Whether you talk about politics or finance or whatever.
Oh, and you know, there the other one, of course, with Yogi Berra, that's now every graduation speaker uses it. If you come to a fork in the road, take it. You know?
Yes. That's the Kantian moment,
yeah,
as a matter of fact. I said I wanted to get into some of the personal side on Bill Vick. He had a good second marriage, apparently.
Very good. And it was a great love story and great, you know, great children.
And his wife is still living here in Chicago.
She's still living here. She's in her early 90s. And Mary Frances Vick, I talked to her many times during the writing of this book. And she is just a wonderfully classy human being, wonderful woman. I think she's still in love with Bill after all the, you know, he's been gone for a long time. And I will meet her face to face tomorrow night for the first time.
Oh, yeah. So. And some of his children are here in town as well.
Yeah. And Bill was a devoted father in that especially during the periods when he was, for example, when he thought he was ill, he would go down to the Eastern Shore, gave his family a great life down there. He loved life. He loved helping people. There were many people, because of the loss of this limb that was this constant amputation, he would go out of his way to help some child in the hospital with an amputation. Or I interviewed a man in Canada who was a history professor who said that Vick became the hero of the Canadian World War II amputees that had come back to Canada. And I think, you know, a lot of these guys at that period coming back from the war, the ones who'd been wounded, the ones who'd been in combat, there was an amazing camaraderie. There's a game in the book, I call it the Purple Heart game. Gene Bearden's a pitcher. This is 1948. Gene Bearden's the pitcher for the Cleveland Indians. The back of his head's been blown out in a torpedo attack. He's been, right after Pearl Harbor, he spent 2 years in the hospital. Is a pitcher for the Philadelphia team. He's lost part of his leg in the Mountain Division, in Lou Brissy in the war in Italy. The relief pitcher's got a Purple Heart. Three members of the outfield have been in combat, of the two teams, the six outfielders together. Mm-hmm. While this is going on, Vick is in the hospital having his second amputation. And I find when I was working on this book that these guys who fought in the war, I interviewed a lot of them, Ralph Kiner, Monty Urban. People don't know that Yogi Berra was on the second day of the D-Day invasion. Monty Urban was in the sixth day. And one of the quotes I use in the book, because of the World Series that occurs in 1948, they ask Warren Spahn, who's going to pitch against the Indians. They said, of Spahn, they say, you're going to pitch in the World Series tomorrow. Is this the most nervous you've ever been in your life? And Spahn says, well, there was the Battle of the Bulge. You know, so I tried to do a lot of that in this book. We really look into that, the importance of all this to people like Vick, that sacrifice and their allegiance to the country. I mean, I think later in life, Vick was not at all happy with he was against the war in Vietnam, but he was a true patriot in the sense that he insisted upon defending the country in time of war.
He dies rather young. He's in about 70 or 71, and it's because of his lifelong habit of smoking.
It's that, and it's a whole combination of things.
But it was lung cancer that got him,
wasn't it? Yes. But he had other conditions as well. Yes, it did. And he smoked prodigious amount. He probably had all the bad habits. He drank a lot of beer. He was going to interview I did with a guy with New York in a restaurant. He ordered extremely rare, and of course that meant they brought, I think he ate some meat sometimes that was quite rare, raw probably. Mm-hmm. But he was a man of just tremendous appetites. But he also had a phenomenal appetite for books. I mean, you read everybody who knew him, everybody I interviewed, one after another, they kept saying, you just couldn't believe the amount of books that man read and his fascination with language and his fascination with reading. So it's been exciting. I started writing my first biography at age 68.
So your first biography, but about your 50th book.
Well, 60-something.
60th book.
Yeah. But you know, but it was, doing a biography is different. It's different than doing a narrative. You can do a narrative. You can write about history, and you can claim that the proximate cause of the Peloponnesian Wars was lack of cellophane, and somebody will probably accept your thesis. But I think when you're doing a biography, it's like holding a bird in your hand. You could easily crush it, and you've got a balance between the fact that this is a real person with real family and real roots, But you also have to tell the truth. And so I when I talked to the family, I had to warn them that there'll be times in the book when you'll want to turn the page quickly because he's not always perfect. But
what's happened to his progeny? There are some 8 kids, are there?
Yeah. There are several of them here. Mike, of course, is the most famous. Mike Vack. He owns a 4 major minor league teams with Bill Murray and a couple of their partners. Bill Murray, the actor, and he's made it. He does a lot of Vackian things. When he took over the St. Paul Saints, he announced that he couldn't afford an instant replay, so he had mimes and leotards do the instant replay. And he got in trouble with the church because on Father's Day he had a drawing for a free vasectomy, things like that. He's quite outrageous and quite funny, and is really been a spark in minor league baseball.
Yeah, making his chip off the old block.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. And Greg is who I've not met, but I've talked to, is a teacher in Western Michigan. He's a major a geographer in geography and works with China, where he and his wife go to China a lot. Lisa's here. She's an editor. Lisa, the daughter. Amaria is an accomplished artist who has a gallery here in Chicago. And another daughter has passed away. And then I'm in touch with at least one of the children from the first marriage, Ellen Vec Maggs.
Mm-hmm.
She's retired as a school teacher, and they're all quite nice people, very very Veckian in their own way. They all Gregory sounds like Bill Vec. He has almost Bill Vec's voice. Mm-hmm. So
we're going to pause and late as usual for some commercials. But before that, it's time to invite telephone calls. We're just now opening the line, or the lines. The number 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200 for questions about Bill Vec, but also any questions you've got about baseball. I haven't made it clear to our listeners, though many of them probably know this by virtue of their being acquainted with some of your other books, but you are you've written on many, many matters, on language, on history, and so on, but also in recent years a great deal on baseball.
Yeah.
So we can have a general baseball discussion. In fact, you've got sort of an encyclopedia of baseball, haven't you?
Well, I have a big baseball dictionary, which is
baseball dictionary.
Yeah, it's a 4.5 bound book with over 10,000 entries and 18,000 definitions. I've been working on it for 25 years.
So, any baseball terms you want to get defined, or that you want to suggest for the dictionary, whatever you want to talk about, so long as it relates to baseball and to Bill Vec, get in there right now. 312-591-7200. For email, if you're listening over the internet at some greater distance and want to reach us that way, the email address, extension720@wgnradio.com, and we return after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly to the phones for your questions to Paul Dixon, author of the book that we've been drawing from this very night, Bill Vec, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. That's just published by Walker. Once again, since we're talking about the book, where is that that bookstore appearance? Friday, isn't it?
Friday at 1 p.m. at the Bookseller in Lincoln Square, which is 4736 North Lincoln here in Chicago.
Excellent. And you'll be talking, probably reading some from the book.
Yeah.
And signing copies.
Yes, and signing copies.
312-591-7200. All the lines were taken until this moment. Now I see there's one line available again. If you've tried to reach us and hitting a busy signal, don't give up. Just try again after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And we go to the first caller, and that is Chris. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Jackie Robinson and Ricky Branch broke the color barrier with the National League. But about 2 months later, Larry Doby did it.
Sir, you didn't listen to this program from the beginning, obviously.
I'm sorry.
Of course, we've talked about all of that. Inevitably, we would. But do you have anything else on your mind?
Well, I also heard that Vec was going to try to get the Athletics at one point.
Yeah, we did that. We did that as well.
1942, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You might want to check out this fine book, Bill Vec by Paul Dixon. 312-591-7200, the number. And we go to Kathy. You are on the air.
This show is a lot of fun tonight. One of the things that I enjoyed about Bill Vec was that I think it was in the late 70s or something, he had a weekend morning show about baseball. He and Mary Frances were on the air for a couple of hours, and it was always fun to listen to him because he was always wandering off the topic. He'd be talking about yesterday's game, and he'd be talking about, such and such a pitcher has a good screwball. That reminds me of a pitcher 10 years ago I saw who did this and that and something else, and he'd go on reminiscing and reminiscing. And Mary Frances had to kind of nudge him back into the present day, but it was a lot of fun listening to both of them.
That sounds great. I mean, that's just exactly, you know, I've listened to a lot of tapes of them together or built separately, and it just, that's just one of his hallmarks, was he could just go off into a different direction, and often brilliantly. And it wasn't just babble. It was sometimes very
quickly. I mentioned that meeting at the bar at Logan Airport at 2 in the morning, or maybe it was only 1 in the morning, but we went on for hours, and basically what we were doing was listening to Bill Beck tell stories.
Yeah. No, he could just do a wonderful story.
And they weren't merely baseball stories.
Yeah.
He had things to say about just about everything.
Yeah. And a lot of the stories were self-deprecating. I mean, he loved to tell stories in which he's the goat.
Quite
he's
so.
The one who who comes on the short end.
Our thanks to the caller. Let me read you an email I've got here from Jeff, who says, great show as always. I thank you for that. Then says, earlier you and your guest mentioned that Bill Beck brought Harry Carey to Chicago from St. Louis. Just for the record, he spent a year or two in Oakland with the A's in between.
You're right.
Yeah. Jeff is right.
Jeff is right. Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And
we pause right now for an update on the news and then right back to the phones and to the email. For phones, 312-591-7200. For email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our guest tonight is, and continues to be until midnight, Paul Dixon, who is the author of the wonderful new book, Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick, that is published by Walker, utterly readable on every page, in every paragraph. There's some great pictures in here as well, which you can't do a biography without some pictures that take you into the life.
Absolutely.
And these are excellently chosen. They do it wonderfully well. And we go back to the phones quickly. At 312-591-7200, Arnie is next. Good evening, sir.
Yes, I have a question. I'm a born and raised Southsider, and maybe my concern is unfounded. But could you talk about the rift between Eddie Einhorn and Reinsdorf with Bill Veeck? I've always sort of held that against Reinsdorf and Einhorn, about there was something going on between those three people. That they didn't want him in the ballpark at one time.
I think it was partially. I think when those guys took over, there were a couple comments made that Bill Veeck took umbrage at. It was something that he considered to be sort of a slur on his period of ownership. And I don't think it was any more profound than a casual comment that was could have been interpreted several different ways. But I think Veeck felt insulted, and his retribution was a typically Chicago one. He then started to show up at the bleachers at Wrigley, where he had started, and that was his payback. And he finally, before the end of his life, he does end up at the at a White Sox game. So there's some degree of reconciliation there. So, but again, he ends up at the bleachers at Wrigley, and then when they stop having day, you could just walk in the day of the game and buy a bleacher seat. Then he gets mad at the owners at Wrigley because he feels that there should always be a place for, you know, real cheap bleacher seats there. And so, but I think in retrospect, I think his great heritage here in Chicago, and one you can't deny, is really when he comes back and he keeps what Veeck did in Chicago was he kept the White Sox here. I mean, they were the second time he came in, they were bound for Seattle. They were going to become the big, they would have become what is now the Seattle Mariners, but prematurely. And Veeck was the one guy. The other owners, they really didn't want him, but they knew he could preserve baseball in Chicago. And I think it's to the everlasting good of Chicago that it's a two-city team. It gives a vitality to the city that, you know, a place like St. Louis lost when they lost one of the teams, or, you know, the teams that were two team cities. So I think maybe too much has been made of that rift. I think it was that. But I think the bottom line in all of this is the reason the Reds, I mean, the White Sox are still in Chicago is because Bill Veeck was stepped up to the plate and saved them.
Our thanks to the caller. Next caller up is Patrick. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, Milt, good evening. And since sounds like a great book. What I'd like to share with you is 1965, my dad, he fell off of a approximately about a 3.5-story building, and they were tuck pointing a building, and his legs got shattered. And he was in the hospital for about, I'm guessing maybe about 6 months. And when he started to become conscious enough to be able to talk to people, family, friends, and stuff, Bill Veeck used to go to that particular hospital, and the hospital escapes me. It was somewhere on the south side of Chicago. But he had visited my dad, and because I guess Bill Veeck was a amputee, and my dad, you know, he had his one leg fused and lost almost the use of his other one. And he went and visited my dad, and he gave him an autographed book for, Veeck as in Rec. And I remember my mom and dad talking about that, and quite honestly, I almost became a Sox fan at that point, but I stuck with the Cubs.
He almost had us in tears, and then you said, "Well, I tell you," but no, exactly what he did. I mean, he did that all the time, and everyone saw the papers would get a hold of a story like that, and he'd get angry. He said, "That wasn't public. I was, that was me acting as a private citizen."
Right, right.
And that was his glory. And he'd read something in the paper. It was one time he reads a Bob Green column in the paper here in Chicago about a guy who can't get work and is really having trouble. He's about to lose his house, and his wife's died. And Veeck calls up, we'll give this guy $10. Everybody the normal way. And Veeck calls up and says, send him out. I'll give him a job. I mean,
yeah.
He's the kind of guy who would react. And I mean, the most famous one, when he's in, I mean, this one's just wonderfully funny. It's not about, people who are being injured. But there's a great time when he's in Cleveland. The guy writes, Night Watchman writes a letter to the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And he said, I'm sick and tired of all this stuff. You have the big night for Lou Boudreau. You have the big night for Bob Feller. I'm a night watchman in a factory, and you never have nights for night like me. I'm the one who pays the bills. I'm the one who pays for Feller's salary. So Veeck sees this letter, and the guy's name is Joe Early. So he has good old Joe Early night, and they have this huge night, and they give him a car, and they give him dancing women and music, and they give him all these prizes. And it was only Veeck could think of something. He would react to something in the paper like that, and of course, nobody's ever done that again, but, imagine that today if somebody, some big major league club had, some night watchman writes a letter and they have a night for him. So what he did with your father is just so typical. And Milt was asking about his private life. A lot of his private life was giving himself to other people who he could, because of his situation, who he could really inspire.
Yeah. And something else, too, that years later, I can't remember the exact year, but I played hardball at McKinley Park on the south side of Chicago, and it was in the late 70s, and Bill Veeck used to go out there and scout. There used to be three diamonds going on at the same time.
He used to
scout himself.
The great,
I got a chance to meet him then.
And the great thing, between ownerships of the White Sox, he moves to the eastern shore of Maryland, down near Easton, Maryland. Okay. And he's down there. He actually goes down there thinking he may be the end of his life down there because he's been diagnosed with serious illness. But when he's down there, he gets watching ball clubs and he gets interested in Little League and in high school ball. And when he comes back to the White Sox, the equivalent of a draft, but he pulls out this guy that nobody's ever heard of named Harold Baines. And
it was
Baines that he'd scouted. And the other true measure of Veeck was Baines is from this very small town in the eastern shore of Maryland, and what he does for Baines is he scouted him, he brings him up, and then he gets him an agent. He said, I don't want this kid to, I want him to get the best deal he can. And then the other thing he did for him was he got him a financial advisor, which a lot of young ball players, they never did.
Sir, we thank you for the call. Very interesting input. And we go quickly to another on 312-591-7200. Bob is our next caller. Good evening.
Good evening. How did Bill Veeck get along with Harry Carey, who could be very critical about the ball club he was announcing?
I think from what I could read, and again, I'm a biographer, I'm not an eyewitness, but what I could glean from the primary sources, what they call historians call primary sources, but different things I read, comments in the paper, all the rest of it. I think it was a fairly, there was a little bit of a arm's distance between the two guys. I think they saw each other as great showmen. I think they saw each other as great, but there wasn't the real deep friendships he had with Harry Grabiner, with Hank Greenberg, with a lot of other people over the, with Larry Doby. They were very deep friendships. That wasn't true of those two guys. I think they were two showmen who understood each other, but were not terribly close.
You might recall that when Joe DiMaggio was negotiating a contract with the Yankees, a very heated negotiation, Bill Veeck interjected that he thought DiMaggio should get what he wanted. And that was another reason why I believe the Yankees and Bill Veeck did not get along.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And, of course, he did all sorts of things. And even when Roger Maris was running for the champion, for the home run title in 61, Veeck claimed the Yankees were actually working against Maris and working to get the attendance to go down as Maris went along. Now, some of this may have been an exaggeration, but again, Veeck watched the Yankees with a hawk eye. He loved to just go after them on their thing. But he loved the players. I mean, he and Stengel got along here and Berra got along. I interviewed Yogi Berra for this book, and he tells about this when Berra would go back to St. Louis in the winter, and that Bill Veeck and Yogi Berra would go to this firehouse in St. Louis and play poker late into the night. And it was like a Saturday Evening Post cover with Veeck and Berra and then some Dalmatian watching them play. But
thank you, sir, for the call. We pause for a quick commercial message or two, and then right back to the phones.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Paul Dixon, author of Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. And directly back to your calls to him on 312-591-7200. John is next. Good evening, sir.
Oh, hello. I don't know if your guest wants to comment on this, but I remember a disco demolition night back in the late 70s, sure. And I knew several people that went there, and one guy I know even wrote a coming-of-age story about it, about traveling there and being there. And
what was that all about?
It was an idea that's a disc jockey here in Chicago, Steve Dahl, had come up with Mike Veeck, and Bill Veeck acceded to it. And it was a promotion that went bad. They were gonna. The idea was in between the two halves of a doubleheader. They were gonna have a big bonfire and burn all this disco music, which were LPs, and it sort of went bad right from the beginning. And people were throwing LP records from the upper decks, and they were coming down like buzzsaw blades, and people were setting fires around the stadium, and it was a bad crowd that got in there. They attracted a crowd that was apparently smoked a lot of marijuana,
oh,
and consumed a lot of booze, and became terribly unruly, and it was not a great night for baseball because they had to forfeit the second game of the doubleheader. And
did Veeck get really bad press on that one?
Yeah, and he came out of the hospital for that one, but in the light of history, it was, you know, he had so many ideas, and he worked, and Mike had so many ideas, mm-hmm. and they worked so many ideas that worked, and this one, you know, it was one of these things that seemed like a good idea at the time, and I think what they weren't prepared for were the number of unruly hooligans who were going to show up and turn it bad. And poor, I think Bill Veeck, it was difficult for him because he had come out of the hospital that day to sort of be there. And here he's out there pleading with everybody to calm down. So it's a sad piece of what happened. But again, as Mike still says today, he said, well, it was a successful promotion, the fact that everybody still remembers it.
I guess. Our thanks to that caller. The next one is Tom. You're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, Mel, Paul. In 1976, Bill Veeck was the guest speaker for the Chamber of Commerce annual dinner out here in Freeport, and I had the privilege of picking Bill up at the old Comiskey Park and driving him out here to Freeport, about a two-hour drive. And I'll never forget how easy he was to talk the whole way. And
more not about his accomplishments, but about the blunders and the mistakes he made in his career. I found that most interesting. And on the baseball side, he talked a lot about Paul Richards. He had the utmost respect for Paul Richards. I think they were together in Cleveland and then in Chicago.
Yeah. And he may have, he was tremendously loyal to people like Paul Richards. And he also, he had this other uncanny ability to discover people. When he's, one of the guys at the one point at the White Sox, he brings in this, he's a lawyer who's been in one of the minor league clubs. And he said, what are you bringing in a lawyer to run the ball club? You should bring in somebody with a deep, long baseball tradition. This is going to be your new manager. And, of course, everybody criticizes him for it, but the guy is Tony La Russa. He brings Tony La Russa up. He's a great eye for talent. He's a great eye. He wants to win, too. I mean, he proves that again and again in Cleveland. He doesn't always work out, but he wins a pennant when he first comes to Chicago. And, of course, many people tell the story that they win the pennant. It was literally when they had the one-game pennant, you didn't have the ladder, you didn't have the playoffs. But a friend of mine who was in Chicago at that time tells a story that he was a young man at the time, and all of a sudden they win the pennant, and everybody watch it on television. They won the game in Cleveland. They didn't win the game here. But they won the game in Cleveland, and everybody's jumping up and down. Finally, we're going to go to the World Series. Finally, the White Sox are going to go to the World Series. And all of a sudden, the sirens start because Mayor Daley had set off the civil defense sirens. And this friend of mine, who's a young guy at the time, says, a guy named Mark Plotnick, who's a pretty well-known political columnist in Washington, he said, here I am. He said, we finally, from the south side of Chicago, he said, we finally get to go to the World Series, and I'm going to die tonight in a thermonuclear attack. That was because nobody expected it was going to go off. And, of course, it was Mayor Daley had told the fire commissioner to set off the alarms. And Beck may or may not have something to do with it, but there were people who reacted viscerally to the sound of an impending nuclear war.
Hey, Paul?
Yeah.
One other thing he talked a lot about, Oakland was hot back then. He didn't have a great fondness for Charlie Finley.
Absolutely, and they were two different guys. I mean, people try to lump them in the same thing. The big difference between Charlie Finley and Bill Veeck was Bill Veeck treated his players with deep respect. There's an interview in the early part of the book with Virgil Trucks who says, I was dealt by Bill Veeck. He had to get rid of me, trade me. And he's the only owner who ever called me into his office and said, I'm sorry I got to do this, but I got to win this. I got to put a team on the field, and I've got to let you go. I really feel bad about it. And, it was just unbelievable that he would do that. So I think the big difference, and the other thing was I think Veeck's real, real respect for the fans Finley did the gimmicks, but I don't think he had the same heart that Bill did.
And we thank that caller, and time being rather short, we'll work in a few more quick calls. Though there is room again on the board, 312-591-7200, and we go to Tom. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Rosenberg. I really appreciate your show. Just a measure of the man, my daughter, when she was in high school, her girlfriend had an English project, and she had to do a report on a famous Chicagoan. So she decided to do Bill Veeck, and she called on a White Sox park, and they said, no, he's busy right now. Give me your name and number, and I'll have him get a hold of you. And she said, yeah, right. So they were at dinner that night, and the phone rings, and one of the other kids answered the phone, and they said, Irene, it's for you. And she says, who is it? Her brother said, it's Bill Veeck. And she says, yeah, right. So she goes to the phone, and he says, yeah, this is Bill Veeck. And she told him, her project and what she had to do. He said, I'll tell you what, why don't you come down here tomorrow, and we can spend, the best part of the day. And Irene and my daughter went down there, and he took them to lunch and gave them an interview for the best part of the day. And I thought for somebody, like Bill Veeck, that was quite an accomplishment.
That's just so typical of me. The other thing he used to do is he would often answer the phone at the ballpark, even in the majors. And answer the phone, somebody called up and said, what time does the game start today? He said, what time can you be here?
Yeah. Really? The kids were just, they were they were so concerned going down, they didn't quite know what they were going to do. When they came back, even though they were high school kids, it was like, you know, their best uncle or their grandfather or something. They just enjoyed themselves, and of course, they couldn't stop talking about it.
That's a lovely story. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. And next up, Jim joins us. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
Actually, I was going to do a negative where I heard where Beck actually almost sold the Sox when he was negotiating with Reinsdorf to Marvin Davis. But the better story I heard was where the Sox, it was a rainy night, and it was threatened to be rained out, and he was actually down with the grounds crew getting the field ready. He was afraid if they got rained out, he was not going to make payroll. Did you ever hear anything about that?
That was typical that he would do stuff like that. He would do anything to keep the game on, and he would, you know, sometimes he would do a little creative groundskeeping in the process, he worked with the groundskeepers. When he came to the White Sox, he had an open office the first time. He was out in a corridor, and, you know, groundskeepers come up and talk to him, and they'd complain. They'd say, I'm having a bad day, and his door was open to everybody. But he got involved in the actual operations of the ballpark. He actually, one time at Comiskey, there's a fighting going on, and he goes out and tries to break up the fight, and he gets slugged. So he gets involved at every level of the ballpark.
Sir, we thank you for the call. Time is rather short, and I want to spend a little time. So apologies to those still on the line, but I want to spend the next 3 minutes, which is about all I've got, to get a little bit more of a picture of another very interesting man, namely you. We know this is your books are now number up into the 60s, and it isn't all about baseball, though you've got a major reputation as a baseball writer, I know.
You know, I write all sorts of books, and I've written a lot of books on American history. I've written a lot of books on American language, the language itself, 20th century history. I do a lot of humorous books. I do a lot of funny books, books of aphorisms. I actually, one point in my life, I decided one of the things every writer should do is produce a joke book. So I wrote a joke book. So I love tour de force. I love to do.
We talked about your book. You were here visiting with that book of aphorisms some years ago.
Yeah, the official rules.
I had the official rules.
Yeah, we had, and you tonight you told me your rule, and this is like Murphy's Law and the Peter Principle, that kind of thing.
I gave you Rosenberg's rule.
Which is?
Everything always gets worse.
There you go.
I think, as I say, I think that subsumes all the others.
That's right. But not tonight, not this show. That's the antidote to Rosenberg's Law.
To be sure. Yeah. There are some variations from it. Good programs are a variation, and this has been a very interesting program. What areas of American history have you focused on?
I've written a big book with Tom Allen on the Bonus Army and veterans, and I wrote a book on Sputnik, the shock of the century, about what happened in 1957 when the Russians beat us into space. Mm-hmm. And I wrote early books. I wrote did one on think tanks about the whole movement towards these policy research organizations, which now are thriving again, but they were when they first grew up. I was wrote about that and several other things like that.
So all sorts of things grab your attention.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have a business card that said "Practice limited to subject of interest." You know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 72. If I went back and visited myself at 19, they said, "Hey, look, you don't have to go to law school. You don't have to cut hair. You can just go out and write about anything you want." And you're going to spend a lot of time writing about outer space and about baseball. And I would have said, you can't do that. You got to go to work.
There are a few freelance writers, and that's basically what you are, who've had such wonderful careers. But you have to have an awful lot of gumption, a lot of intelligence, and the words have to flow easily.
Thank you. I hope that's true.
Well, it's clearly very much the case. The book that we've been drawing from all night in this conversation with Paul Dixon is titled, surprisingly, Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. And with that, we'll close down in just a moment. I should tell you that tomorrow we're talking with Josh Meyer, who's the author of a new book titled The Hunt for KSM. That's Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's about to go on trial at last, the man who really masterminded the 9/11 attack. And from whom a great deal has been learned, partly through waterboarding him, to be sure, but a fascinating, strange, strange figure in modernity. So that's tomorrow at 10. And until then, my cordial thanks to all for listening, and indeed, speaking of cordiality, a cordial good night to all.